Yeats in 1913 said that Ireland was like plastic, that it was ready to be moulded.
Where you're really seeing the end of empire, and Ireland being part of the largest empire in the world was a very important aspect to that.
Dublin had more unskilled workers than any other city on these islands.
What you have is 20,000 households who are living in one room.
I can still smell it. I can remember walking into rooms and they were divided by sheets from the ceiling.
But the great thing that they always talked about was the closeness of the people to one another and the sharing of everybody had.
If Jim Larkin's great achievement was to unite workers in the belief they could actually win better conditions, William Martin Murphy's achievement was to unite employers, Catholic and Protestant, that they could beat the other side.
But soon the strike was seen in terms of a clash between Murphy and Larkin.
Murphy was constantly being lampooned as the viper of Dartry Hall, where he lived, a worker's tyrant.
The curious thing about Connolly and Larkin is that their ideas were absolutely identical, and yet they didn't much like each other.
History was written by men, so an awful lot of women that contributed to Irish society have been written out.
I think it is right that we give fair truck to the William Martin Murphy aspect and on the path it sent us on.
But it was tragic, the way it ends. But Larkin was still loved.
It was a very traumatic experience, but it did give the people of Dublin and Ireland the belief that they could change things.
It's been presented as this great labour dispute and it was a success. It wasn't. It was not a success. These men had nothing. Their families had nothing. Their children had nothing.
It seems to me that you could make a huge parallel between what's happening now in Ireland and what happened in the period before the lockout.
Sometimes I think we look back at the lockout and its legacy and we read history backwards.
There's a real danger of commemoration being a form of nostalgia rather than trying to extract from what happened 100 years ago messages and challenges for today.
Citizens.
Lockout. 1913 to 2013.
Dublin in January 1913, in the run-up to the August strike, is very much a tale of two cities, with the extremes of affluence and poverty, of both high society and low life. It's an Edwardian city of music halls, vaudeville, pub culture and street songs. From the Theatre Royal to the Queen's, the Gaiety to the Tivoli, Dublin boasts seven theatres, far more than Belfast.
And don't forget, boys and girls, to join in the chorus.
And a nationalist theatre is emerging, the Abbey, which was founded by W.B. Yeats and Lady Gregory just 9 years earlier, and which has already seen public riots over Singh's Playboy of the Western World. Helena Maloney, a leading activist with the Women's Workers Union, is herself an Abbey actress, and they're on tour in the United States. On Grafton Street, the Grafton Picture House has opened, showing silent movies. James Joyce had been one of the pioneers of cinema when he returned to Dublin to open the short-lived Volta a few years earlier. But now there's a popular demand for sentimental movies like the 1912 Edison Studio hit, The Land Beyond the Sunset, where the slum children escape to a better world. And if you've money, you can buy a gramophone and John McCormack 78 records, like Mukushla. In a photograph of the time, we see an elegant shopping street, men in frock coats, women in hats and gloves, and Union Jacks flying not far from White's Academy, where Bewley's Cafe now sits. Many of those big stores and businesses like Switzer's are part of William Martin Murphy's Employers' Federation, which moved to lock out union workers by the end of August. Around College Green, motor cars are beginning to appear. Henry Ford's Model T car, or the Thin Lizzie, becomes the ultimate symbol of the new mechanical age. But just beyond are the crammed inner city tenements where tens of thousands of Dubliners live a vulnerable existence and where breakfast is more important to secure than all the tools and toys of the 20th century.
No inconsiderable number of the poor get out of their beds or substitutes for them without knowing when they are to get their breakfast, for the simple reason that they have neither money nor credit. They must starve if they have got nothing which would be taken in pawn. Articles of very small value will be accepted by the pawnbroker, and some items of a slender wardrobe are exchanged for the price of one or more meals. So small a sum as sixpence may be obtained in this way.
The words there of Sir Charles Cameron, Dublin City's public health officer, writing in How the Poor Live, where he calls the pawn shops the bankers of the poor. James Stevens, in his novel The Charwoman's Daughter, published in 1912, captures this divided city with the story of Mary Makebelieve and her cleaner mother, who live in a dark one-room tenement. Mary loves to daydream about the world they're excluded from as she walks along Grafton Street, looking in the shop windows.
And so she knew daily everything that was new in the city, and was able to tell her mother at night time that the black dress with the Spanish lace was taken out of Manning's window, and a red gown with tucks at the shoulders and Irish lace at the wrists put in its place. Or that the diamond ring in Johnson's, marked £100, was gone from the case, and that a slide of brooches of beaten silver and blue enamel was there instead. In the night time, her mother and herself went round to each of the theatres in turn and watched the people going in and looked at the big posters. When they went home afterwards, they had supper and used to try to make out the plots of the various plays from the pictures they had seen, so that generally they had lots to talk about before they went to bed.
While Stevens vividly describes the world of the tenements in The Charwoman's Daughter, and he is a contemporary author of the lockout period, his story actually ignores the union battles. Leanne Lane, head of Irish Studies at the Mater Dei Institute, says Stevens chooses to give his poor a fairy tale escape.
These are people who really exist on the margins of society. And it's really interesting that Stevens is depicting this at the time. Stevens, of course, would have himself been very much familiar with poverty. He, you know, was the son of a van driver, was arrested for begging in 1886, sent to industrial school. So he's actually coming from a depiction of poverty. He's lived through it. But it's interesting that he doesn't make any reference to trade union activism. And in a way, the novel is a fairy tale. At the end of The Charwoman's Daughter, there's no social revolution. There's no attempt to eradicate poverty through union activism or through worker solidarity. Mary Makebelieve's uncle has died in America. He leaves them an inheritance and they escape poverty in that type of fairy tale ending.
So it's a bit like Edison's film. James Stevens chooses to magic away the grim reality of poverty. Historian Mary Daly at University College Dublin has been taking a look at the health of those stuck in the slums, where life's particularly tough for children.
One of the things that makes Dublin stand out is infant mortality. It's beginning to improve in other cities in England and Scotland and Wales. It's not really improving in Dublin. If you go back to the 1880s, Dublin isn't particularly unhealthy. It's very unhealthy by modern standards, but it's not particularly unhealthy for children relative to other places. By 1911 or so, it is unhealthy for children. The other thing that's very significant is that you're getting into this TB epidemic at this stage. TB hits Dublin later than most British cities as well. It's an infectious disease and it begins to really take hold, and the peak of the epidemic is in Dublin, is 20th century, whereas in a lot of English cities it's 19th century. The incidence of TB in people living in one-room tenements is much higher than the incidence of those who are not living in one-room tenements. I think it's important to bear in mind that the poor weren't the only people who got TB. I think if you go through any middle-class professional family background, you will find TB in the family somewhere or other. So it's not just the poor, but it was so much worse in the poor. I mean, it spread just through the contact in the tenements. It also spread through milk. A lot of the milk in Dublin was provided by dairies that were in the centre of Dublin. But tubercular cows, for example, mean you're drinking TB, literally, and there was a lot of that going around at the time.
And Mary, it seems to me that one of the stark realities of health at the time is that while diseases like syphilis, TB, typhoid are common, there's really no treatment. If you get ill, there's not much that they can do for you.
There was actually very little that medicine could do for you other than tender nursing care and, you know, soothe the fevered brow, give you clean bed. In other words, nursing is about as much as was available. I mean, there are no drugs of any consequence available. None of the drugs that we know of, antibiotics and such like, don't become available anywhere until the late 1930s. Sulfonamides, penicillin is just after World War II. So bluntly, if you became ill, there is almost nothing that can be done for you except let you go through the illness and make sure you're not dehydrated. So illness was not something where you could, you might survive it, but you cannot really expect medical treatment or a cure in most instances. So it's a really, really scary event. And I think the other thing to bear in mind are the number of children who would have died of things like measles, because these children would have been malnourished and debilitated. And there's the horrible comment again by Cameron, if they hadn't died from measles, they'd probably have died from something else, which sounds a bit chilling, but it's probably factually correct.
Some men faint-hearted ever seek our programme to retouch, and will insist whene'er they speak that we demand too much. 'Tis passing strange, yet I declare such statements give me mirth, for our demands most moderate are, we only want the earth.
Throughout 1912, Jim Larkin's union, the Transport and General Workers' Union, and Delia Larkin with the Irish Women's Workers' Union have been aggressively recruiting. But both sides, the rich and the poor, have their music. If the quality could pay to see and hear international tenors like Caruso when they came, the trade union movement has its songs and marching bands. They created both male and female choirs. James Connolly himself is a songwriter. We're listening to his ballad, We Only Want the Earth, arranged by Manus O'Riordan and sung here by Michael Gallen.
Their sympathies assure us too, if our demands were fewer.
Most this is how Larkin's message is spread, through songs and poems published in the union's newspaper, The Irish Worker. Trade union historian Francis Devine, who is himself a singer, has researched how the songs are a powerful tool.
I think songs were popular at the time because, in the absence of what we would experience today, of television, radio, etc., an awful lot of entertainment took place either in the homes or in the street or in courtyards, and people sang. And it's pretty obvious from attendances at things like music hall and so on that songs were very popular. In the case of the labour movement, there was a tradition, which I think predates 1913, of people singing songs, often to music hall tunes, or traditional airs.
Our feet upon the upward path are set where none.
Sometimes, and this was the great strength of the Irish Worker, they would diminish the status of the good and the great by parody or by lampooning or by poking fun. So the songs of the 19 in the Irish Worker did that.
Slave in all our ranks appears, our proudest boast in labour's host were freedom's pioneers.
Oh, slaves. The ballads and songs, the poems, the squibs in the Irish Worker, which incidentally was read by 100,000 people a month, 20,000 a week. And at the top of the Irish Worker, it often encouraged readers, when you've read it, pass it on. So the readership was very significant. Now, there were problems with literacy in some quarters, so you can sort of imagine, particularly the poems and the songs, that they would have been performed in tenements and in pubs and so on.
Of guilt would crumble in an hour.
At the end of the Wexford lockout in January, February 1912, Connolly wrote We Are Freedom's Pioneers to the air of We Are the Boys of Wexford. And it was sung the night the dispute ended in victory for the workers. And within weeks was, in sheet music terms, in today's parlance, a number one hit, and was sung around the city.
we scorn their foolish fears. Be this our plan, to lead the van with freedom's pioneers.
I'm over at Liberty House, an old flat complex in Dublin's north inner city. It's between Connolly Station and O'Connell Street, to meet Terry Fagan, who grew up here in what was corporation buildings, and who for decades now has been collecting the stories of local people as part of the Inner City Folklore Project.
The area where I would have grown up with, people know, would have been kind of the Monto area, which would be based in around what's now today they call it James Joy Street. But that was originally called Mabbott Street, then renamed in 1906 to Corporation Street. And the Monto end of it would have had a street called Montgomery Street. The City Fathers changed all the names of the streets. They renamed Montgomery Street to Foley Street. Like, you know, corporation buildings, there were only one room. Most families had large families in those houses. But when they were opened in 1906, the thing about them was they were luxury apartments. And the reason why they were luxury apartments, because they had running water and toilets inside them. For 1906, in that period, it was something unheard of, because most of the tenements that were in Dublin, everything was out in the backyard. You had the toilets in the backyard, you had the one tap, the single tap out in the backyard, and every 100 people living in a tenement house would use that one toilet. So you can imagine the state of it. But corporation buildings was something unique in the sense that it had that toilet and scullery in it and the whole lot. But the rooms measured about 12 feet by 18 feet, and it could only hold one bed. And how most people survived having large families in those rooms was, the beds in those days were the big steel brass bed type of things, and the base was up off the floor. So people stacked the mattresses underneath the bed. And then in the night time, they would push back the furniture and spread the mattress out along the floor, and the kids would sleep on the floor.
So Terry, what kind of stories did people tell you about life in the tenements?
I asked one woman to describe inside the tenement house, what it was in it. Well, she said we had a table, and said, and basically there was a couple of broken chairs and boxes that we sat on, the whole lot, one bed. And for my mother and father to have a bit of privacy, they had a rope going across the room with a blanket thrown over or a sheet thrown over. So they'd be kind of isolated. They were in their bed and we were behind the thing, the whole lot. And that was their privacy in the whole lot. They talk about the life in those houses, and they talk about the conditions that they lived in. Like, I mean, what they were living in was feverness. There was diphtheria, there was TB, there was all sorts of diseases. And one woman told me, said, in the dead hour of the night or coming into the morning time, you'd hear the screams of women screaming, because some of the children would have died of TB and things like that. And of course, the family would be in an awful state. But the women would scream out, and the neighbours would come to them, the whole lot. But the great thing that they always talked about was the closeness of the people to one another and the sharing of everybody had. You know, there was always somebody coming for a cup of milk. In those days, it was a jam jar they used. Like, the jam jar was the tenement china.
Well, if you've got a wingo, take her up to Ringo, where the waxy singo all the day.
Now, Terry Fagan mentioned the Monto, and Dublin's a city of military barracks and a busy port, soldiers and sailors. And by 1913, it's earned a reputation as a city of prostitution. The Monto district, the block of streets near Amiens Street railway station and O'Connell Street, is an infamous red light area. Joyce brings it to life in the nighttime scene in Ulysses. But the Monto is just one of the city's red light zones. Harcourt Street is another. And there's reputed to be about 1,600 prostitutes working in the city. Here's Mary Daly.
There was a huge hoo-ha about 5 or 6 years before the lockout about the Encyclopaedia Britannica, which said that Dublin was quite different to anywhere else in Europe. The nearest thing to it was Port Said, apparently, on the Suez Canal, and the prostitutes openly walked down the main street. And this was, you know, not seen apparently elsewhere in Europe. So it has this reputation. And I think, to be fair to the women concerned, there is very little by way of any alternative livelihood for women in the city. The domestic servant jobs, resident jobs in houses went to girls from the country. They were seen as much more deferential, probably healthier as well, and they would have got the live-in servant jobs. The Dubliners would have done maybe the laundry work, the hard scrubbing, they would have come in, but they wouldn't have got jobs as domestic servants. Similarly, the jobs, if you looked at somewhere like Cleary's department store, the shop assistants there would mainly have been from the country as well. Dublin girls didn't get jobs in places like that. So really, the employment opportunities for Dublin women trying to make a livelihood for themselves and to contribute to their family. This is not self-fulfillment, this is survival, were extremely limited indeed. And dealing was quite common for that reason. I mean, that's why so many of them did sell on the street and did become market traders.
The Monto song itself is a bit like a false memory, a fake relic, in that it was written in 1958 by an Irish Times critic of all people, George Hodnett, who wrote it more or less to mock Irish folk songs, but in the end it became what it pretended to be. The diverging cultures which play out in the lockout are perhaps best illustrated in two letters written to the press in January. The first to the Irish Times by Maud Gonn, whose women's network, Inyad na hÉireann, is providing meals for school children, and she's responding to Sir Charles Cameron's figures on the alarming rise in child mortality.
Alone among civilised nations, Ireland allows her children to starve and provides for no medical inspection in the schools. So tuberculous children sit on crowded benches with starving but otherwise healthy children, and naturally the contagion spreads.
And the other is from the country's most prominent businessman, William Martin Murphy, writing to the newspaper he owns, the Irish Independent, about his opposition to a proposed new river gallery to house Hugh Lane's art collection.
Speaking for myself, I admire good pictures and I think I can appreciate them. But as a choice between the two, I would rather see in the city of Dublin one block of sanitary houses at low rents replacing a reeking slum than all the pictures Corot and Degas ever painted.
Maud Gonn is in Paris by this stage, trying to keep her own children out of the way of her estranged husband, John McBride. But she comes back and forth to Dublin and lobbies relentlessly, along with Helena Maloney, for Dublin Corporation to face its responsibilities.
In many of the yearly health reports, Sir Charles Cameron has urged medical inspection and free meals for necessitous schoolchildren. I am sorry to say he has urged it in vain. The authorities have taken no notice. The Ladies' School Dinner Committee, for over 2 years, has been distributing 450 free dinners in two of the poorest schools in the city to demonstrate how easily and how economically the free meals can be arranged. One penny will provide a pint of Irish stew for each child, and about half of this amount is sufficient for the very small children. Want of funds prevents our extending our work, which is only temporary, until such time as the Dublin Corporation will agree to do what the corporation of all the great cities in Europe are doing, providing free meals for necessitous school children. Maud Gonn, 17, Rue de l'Annonciation, Passy, Paris.
Murphy, on the other hand, is ill for much of the first half of 1913 and out of the boardroom. But while Larkin's movement is pushing to get a foothold in the key city workplaces like Guinness's and Murphy's Tramway Company, Murphy himself is obsessed with stopping the Hugh Lane Gallery. He sees it as frivolous and vain. He dislikes Hugh Lane, Lady Gregory's nephew, and lobbies for a traffic bridge to accommodate the new automobiles, rather than turning the Halfpenny Bridge into a Florence-style river gallery. Ironically, while Maud Gonn supports the gallery, Murphy, in one of his many letters to The Independent, uses her school meals campaign to make his case.
Dear Sir, the money to be spent on the gallery would go a long way to feed the necessitous school children, which the corporation have power to do, but there is no money and no special meeting for such a purpose. French pictures are apparently more precious in the eyes of our democratic corporation than the provision of food for the hungry children of the slums. W.M. Murphy, Dartry.
Historian Kieran Wallace of Trinity College Dublin sees it as Murphy defining his vision for Ireland, which was enterprise over Lane's one of arts.
Both these men had different visions for Ireland for the future. They were all expecting Home Rule to arrive any day now. So you had these two conflicting visions for Ireland. One is this modern art gallery bridge and another as a traffic and industry and economics bridge.
And Kieran, what do you think was Murphy's motivation?
He was a very able businessman, very able politician. I presume he saw for himself a very constructive and positive role in the New Ireland. He could have been a hard-headed Belfast businessman. He was that kind of personality that we tend to attribute to sort of a strong unionist shipyard owner or something. Yet he was a Cork man, a devout Catholic, huge international business, great employer, apparently personally very nice man, big interest in charity all his life, lifelong member of the Vincent de Paul, that sort of thing. But perhaps by modern standards, quite a narrow version of what Ireland would be in his book.
In the end, it's the collapse of the Church Street tenements at the beginning of the lockout, with the death of seven people, which seals the faith for the Hugh Lane Gallery.
It was around this time that the houses on Church Street collapsed, and this totally focused, this idea of two or three houses on Church Street collapsing, this tragedy right in the city centre, focusing all the highlight on the slum question, and this made the idea of giving money to build a gallery when we should be building fresh housing, this became a big problem. So the support dissipated.
Lane's collection went to London instead, and Murphy's blamed by both W.B. Yeats and A.E. Russell for that loss. Yeats famously lashed Murphy in his poem September 13, but perhaps his most pointed attack is in another poem, To a Shade, where he sees Parnell revisiting Dublin.
A man of your own passionate serving kind, who had brought in his full hands what, had they only known, had given their children's children loftier thought, sweeter emotion, working in their veins like gentle blood, has been driven from the place. And insult heaped upon him for his pains and for his open-handedness, disgrace. Your enemy, an old foul mouth, had set the pack upon him.
Yeats's dig, your enemy, an old foul mouth, goes back to Murphy's opposition to Parnell at the time of the parliamentary party split. Here's Pádraig Yeats, lockout author on William Martin Murphy.
He'd been a Home Rule MP in the late 1880s, but interesting enough, when the Parnell split came, he effectively bankrolled the anti-Parnellites. Dublin remains staunchly Parnellite, unlike most of the country, and he lost his seat. And although he ran on three separate occasions for safe nationalist seats, he was always defeated by another nationalist candidate. He was a very private person, so it makes it very hard to know the man. So we know very little of him, and he seems to have left no papers of any significance behind him. Even friends, I mean, P.A. Chance, who was an in-law and would have considered himself a friend, or Tim Healy, in their memoirs, always said they never really knew William Martin Murphy. They knew what he wanted, and they knew what his concerns were, but they didn't know him really as a person. And P.A. Chance famously described him as a man who carried the imitation of Christ in one hand and the Company's Act in the other.
Perhaps because of that, Murphy has tended to be seen as one-dimensional, the bad guy in the story. But it was that lack of context which attracted his biographer, Jesuit Thomas Morrissey, to his character.
Partly, I think, on the grounds that nobody could be as bad as he was depicted. And then turned out in point of fact that he was quite a rich and strong personality and not at all the ogre presented by Larkin. He was described as a man with an iron fist and a silken glove, you know, that he was a very pleasant man to meet, quite unobtrusive, very intelligent. But once he set his mind to something, then he carried it out almost ruthlessly in many ways.